Welcome to Holden Village. Today, in the incredible Creekside Room, today's speaker is Roland James, and he will be speaking on economic justice for a small planet. So let's listen in on Roland James.
I've really enjoyed my time here. I've tried to sit in on other classes, and I think I've sat in on every other person who's been here teaching a class this week at least one time, and I've enjoyed all of them. Steve Zunis is actually coming to the Phoenix area in November, and we hope to set up for a conference, and we hope to set up a couple of speaking engagements for him while he's there. So one way that I guess Holden kind of spreads out. Also had the chance to get in a couple of hikes, so that was nice too. I was going to play a little bit of Les Miserables. Has anyone heard that before, the tape from that? Or if you've heard it,
I've seen the play.
If you've seen the musical play or the musical?
Yeah, I don't care.
Well, perhaps later if we run out of things to do. But Les Mis was written by Victor Hugo in the 19th century and is considered by many to be maybe the best novel of the 19th century. And it's turned into what some consider to be the best musical production of the 20th century, because it combines both the personal and the political in a way that most productions don't do. And it has all these complex themes and threads woven through it. And the music is quite good, too. I've seen most Broadway productions, not on Broadway, either in Phoenix or in some other city, a couple of them on Broadway. And have generally not been very impressed. Went to see Cats and thought, well, this is really going to be great because everybody is saying what a great show it is. And I was kind of let down. There's one good song in it, Memories, but I wasn't terribly thrilled by any of the rest of it.
I think that's the one that sticks out in most people's minds. That's the one you hear played differently.
Yeah, yeah. I'd like to start with a little meditation. Can a person be a Christian in today's world? Lee Atwater, a former chairperson of the Republican Political Party and chairperson of George Bush's political campaign in 1988, stated the problem very well on his deathbed a couple of years ago, where he joined the Roman Catholic Church before meeting his maker. Atwater asked forgiveness for making Willie Fortman an election issue and added, "My illness helped me to see that what was missing in society is what was missing in me." The 80s were about acquiring wealth, power, prestige. I know. I acquired more wealth, power, and prestige than most. But you can acquire all you want and still feel empty. It took a deadly illness to put me eye to eye with that truth. But it is a truth that the country, caught up in its ruthless ambitions and moral decay, can learn on my dime. I don't know who will lead us through the 90s, but they must be made to speak to this spiritual vacuum at the heart of American society, this tumor of the soul. With this tumor of the brain, Atwater discovered a tumor in his soul. He is truly a prophet for today's world. Would that all of us would be so fortunate, and perhaps before we get to our deathbed. I'd like to read another couple of paragraphs from an article that appeared about four years ago. The title of the article is "Returning to See a Smug, Scared U.S." correspondent sees abundance ugliness in American life. By Stanley Meiser, Meiser. So originally appeared in the Los Angeles Times. You can hear the moments of boredom tick away whenever you tell Americans that no other industrial democracy has the same dispiriting problems as the United States. Not the crime, not the guns, not the homeless, not the unschooled, not the poor, not the racism, not the ugliness. Listeners may mimic interest for a short while, then their glances roll up and roll away. They may not doubt me, but content in smugness, they do not care. After 21 years as a foreign correspondent, I returned home late last year to a country bristling with astonishing problems, most left untended. Yet many Americans persist in believing that their country has a divine mission on earth, a model for all others. Ignorance about the rest of the world seems total. Our son left for high school the other day in a t-shirt emblazoned with a bust of Lenin. I jokingly warned him to be careful. "Don't worry," he said cynically, not jovially. "No one at school knows who he is." They probably thought he was John Lennon, the Beatles member. This was Vladimir Lenin, the the Soviet. I'll just read a couple more paragraphs. "Few, if any, people can boast as much democracy and energy as Americans. Those are wondrous gifts that foreigners can hardly fathom. Yet I often wonder now to what purposes they are put. Fear of crime quickly makes a returning American feel the reality of home. On one winter night, I walked across five dim, deserted Washington blocks, wondering whether it might have been wiser to take a cab. There is no such fear in most cities of Western Europe and Canada. Almost all of downtown Paris, for example, bustles with carefree revelers at all hours before dawn. Crime does exist, but if Los Angeles had the homicide rate of Paris, it might consider disbanding its police force." I'm not a teacher by training, so this has been kind of a new experience for me. Most of the people here are teachers all the rest of the year. I do a lot of reading, and I'm involved in a lot of issues, both at work and in avocations that I pursue. I'm the chairperson of the Valley Religious Task Force on Central America, an organization that the village pastor started back in about 1980, and I'm also president of the Phoenix Veterans for Peace. I perhaps seem somewhat disjointed at times because I haven't had much training at this, and this is a new experience for me. This issue of economic justice on a small planet is very complex, and it's a topic for at least one semester. I'll attempt to kind of go over some of what I see as some of the overall issues. I've got three handouts, and then maybe we can have a little bit of discussion. Janet has joined us. Janet, Bill, John, Sven, and I don't know your name.
Yay.
Okay. And let's see here.
Carl and Rosemary.
I thought I had it, but I wasn't sure. So, okay. I noticed, or someone told me, that the temperatures in Seattle the last couple of days were warmer than the temperatures in the Southwest. And increasingly over the last few years, we've had this wide variability in weather, sometimes causing floods, such as in the Mississippi Valley in the spring of 1993. A very dry Colorado this summer led to the deaths of 14 firemen. Insurance companies increasingly are worried about this because of their bottom line. They're paying out huge amounts. And they're concerned. And they're probably more concerned than most people. But others are concerned too. Scientists in the 1980s kind of developed what they referred to as the greenhouse theory. And on a small scale, it makes a lot of sense. If you enclose something in glass, usually you'll get a warming effect inside that enclosure. Carbon dioxide is usually a benign chemical compound, chemical or benign gas. In fact, when we breathe in oxygen, we breathe out some carbon dioxide. It's a very small percentage of the Earth's atmosphere, about 1/3,000. But that has been increasing rather dramatically since World War II, with the advent of many automobiles, and which also put out quite a bit of carbon dioxide, and many coal power plants and other things. The scientists, aren't sure whether or not this is going to be a disaster for us or not, whether or not it's going to warm up our planet by, some of them say, as much as 4 or 5 degrees centigrade or 9 or 10 degrees Fahrenheit, which would be a rather dramatic increase in overall average temperature increase. If it does warm up that much, we'll have some rather dramatic changes to the area where we grow most of our food in the United States. Will probably move into Canada, and they'll have much more temperate climate, and it might be very good for Canada. Many of the cities along our coasts will be flooded because much of the ice caps will be melted. But even in the short term, this has effects, or perhaps has effects. And the scientists don't say that every year will be warmer. They say that if you take a piece of, or a dice, die, and it has 6 sides. If you paint 2 of those sides green, 2 of those to represent the normal weather, 2 of those sides red to represent hotter than normal weather, and 2 of those sides blue to represent colder than normal weather, in a normal period of time, if you flip that, weather is variable. You will get 2 years that are warmer than normal, 2 years that are normal, and 2 years that are colder than normal. With the greenhouse effect, they say that you're going to change the variability probably. And you're going to have maybe 3 years that are warmer than normal. You'll get 3 reds. You probably still get 2 greens, normal. And you'll get 1 that's colder than normal. And perhaps that's what we had this last winter in much of our country, when it was colder than normal. The newspaper in Arizona, the major newspaper in Arizona, made much of this in an editorial. They said that scientists who are concerned about this problem were meeting in Washington, D.C., and they had to cancel their meeting because of snow and cold weather. And they said, well, this proves that the greenhouse effect isn't true. Well, I think they spoke too soon. But I think we have to wait a little bit, and even if it is true, the scientists have never said that we won't have colder than normal weather at times. Maybe for a whole winter. What does this have to do with economic justice? If the rest of the world wants to live like we do in the United States and in the other industrial democracies, that means that China and India in particular, and the other 5 billion people that make up the planet now, will be building a lot of coal plants, driving a lot of cars, and the greenhouse problem will be maybe much more dramatic than it is now if we continue going on the path that we're going without these people developing as we have. The World Bank, which is primarily controlled and dominated by the United States, and the International Monetary Fund, also controlled and dominated by the United States, have loaned billions of dollars over the last 2 or 3 decades. And they primarily are interested let me just take one of these, pass it along. They're primarily interested in large-scale development. Large hydroelectric plants and transportation infrastructure, so that people maybe in some of these countries will be able to, you know, have all the electrical appliances that we do and the cars that we do. Unfortunately, many of these countries could not pay those loans back. They just didn't have the wherewithal. They're poor countries, many of them. So in the 1980s, we had what was called structural adjustment. And the loans were refinanced, but those countries had to go through a process in order to refinance the loans. And it was generally a process that meant you have to cut back on social welfare programs in your country. These are already very poor countries. You have to grow crops for export rather than grow crops for domestic use. Many of these countries have many hungry people. For example, Brazil, according to Carmen, who's here, says that 40 million people are on the verge of starvation in Brazil. About 1/3 of the population of 120 million. Well, if you cut back on social programs, if you start growing crops for export rather than for domestic use, that means that you exacerbate that gap between rich and poor in Brazil or in any other country that's been a recipient of these World Bank or IMF loans. And to my way of thinking, you make things worse. To the elites of Brazil, who perhaps are getting wealthy or more wealthy than they are, they're kind of happy with this situation, maybe. Gridlock is a word that has been coined by David Brower on the front side of that. And I'd like to read something that is not included in this. There's an article there, and then there's a lot of little articles that I try to include on the page, and I hope it's not too confusing. Some of those little articles don't have much to do with the main article about Brower. Consider the 6 days of Genesis as a figure of speech for what has been in fact 4 billion years. On this scale, a day equals 660 million years. All day Monday, creation was busy getting the earth going. Life began Tuesday noon, and the beautiful organic wholeness of it developed over the next 4 days. At 4 p.m. Saturday, on the sixth day, reptiles came. At 9 p.m. Saturday, on the sixth day, redwoods appeared. At 3 minutes before midnight on the sixth day, Christ arrived. At 1/40th of a second before midnight, the Industrial Revolution began. We are surrounded by people who think that what we've been doing for that 1/40th of a second can go on indefinitely. They are considered normal. But according to Mr. Brower, they are stark raving mad. It's kind of a pessimistic view, maybe, but I think he kind of puts it in perspective. On the reverse side of that, you see an article that I wrote. Actually, I've got part of an article I wrote over on the left-hand side, and then a whole article I wrote there, kind of in on the right-hand side, Water in the Balance. And in the box of that article, I won't read much of it, but you can read it later if you like. It says, for the world economy to expand, people need more income. Where does it come from? This is kind of a paradox. In every sense, it comes from the environment. We have a throughput economy, huge inputs of raw materials to create a vast array of products and a huge waste stream. Some of the Europeans are starting to deal with some of these issues in a more organized way than we are in the United States and in Canada. They have value-added tax and pollution taxes. They oftentimes require that, for example, if a car, I think they're starting to do this in Germany, if a car ends up around a telephone pole, they want essentially the metal, the plastic, to be returned to some repository. We do some of that in this country, but not nearly as much as in other countries. A little bit more optimistic view is put out by, and this magazine is in the library here. It's called World Watch. It's a magazine of World Watch, Working for a Sustainable Future. The main person involved with World Watch is a guy by the name of Lester Brown, and this just appeared in June. Some of the world's dreams are coming true, but ecological AIDS nightmares are still keeping us up. The dream of a world where nuclear weapons disappear, light bulbs last for years, bicycles outsell cars, and people live longer is coming true. The good news, some of it surprising on a planet tainted by pollution and shaken by post-Cold War violence, is part of a World Watch Institute's Vital Signs 1994 report. But overall, the planet is not doing so well, said Lester R. Brown, World Watch president and principal author of the compilation of trends. Of all the key indicators measuring the health of the planet, we have succeeded in reversing the decline in only one, namely the manufacture and production of chlorofluorocarbons, or CFCs, that deplete the ozone layer. All the other trends, carbon emission, deforestation, loss of species, population growth, and soil erosion, are still headed in the wrong direction. Some key signs, I'll just read one more thing here. Some key signs in the compilation that bode ill for the world. Birds are disappearing, with 2/3 of all species on the decline and 1,000 species threatened with extinction. So that's kind of the backdrop of I think environmental issues will probably be the major national security issue for the United States in the 21st century. and for the world too, for all, for other countries. The United States consumes about, we spend about 10% of our gross national product on energy. We're a big country, so some of that is understandable. Japan and Germany spend about 5% of their gross national products on energy. And they're smaller countries, are more compact. They don't have the transportation costs that we do. But Germany and Japan also are much more efficient in their manufacturing processes, and they retain about double the percentage of their workers in manufacturing that we do. They're at about one-third of their workers in manufacturing, and we're down to about one-sixth. And manufacturing is very energy intensive usually. So there's a lot of room for improvement, and many people think that, that environmental issues are just waste and recycling and what you do with the products that you've already used. But I think more important is what you consume at the front end. And if you can do that more efficiently and still live a good life, I think you've made a huge contribution to the benefit of the world. I have another little handout here. Are any of you familiar with Bread for the World? This is by the director of Bread for the World. It appears in another magazine that's here in the library called Salt. This is the current issue, the July-August issue. It's called Economics for a Small Planet. David Beckman used to be with the World Bank, who I just criticized. And he's also criticized in the third handout I'm going to give you by Waldo Bello of Food First, who wrote the book that I recommended called Dark Victory, and they kind of had a little debate going. But I think David, who I attended a conference on these issues, hunger issues, in Phoenix about a year and a half ago, where David was. Ray McKeever was also there. And I think David has some good things to say in this particular article. Turning to the last column on the back page, he talks there in answer to a question about what are the strengths churches bring to the work for global economic justice. And I won't read the first couple of paragraphs, but in the last column he talks about, I think of this task in biblical terms. In the book of Kings, King Josiah is praised as the great reformer of the temple and as one who rediscovered the law of God. Josiah was the best king Judah had for a long time. But you get a completely different perspective from Jeremiah, who was a contemporary of King Josiah. He was saying, it's hopeless. This society is absolutely corrupt and God is going to come in judgment. I think I tend to be more Jeremiah-like than Josiah-like. I come to see the glass half empty rather than half full. I don't know if any of you were here during the little discussion that Steve Zunis and I had kind of back and forth. He's a little bit more optimistic than I am. There is a role in our churches for the Jeremiahs who say, achieve anything good in the World Bank? Achieve anything good through the U.S. government? Impossible. Let's go off and live a dramatically different kind of life and denounce the evils of the world. Well, I don't know if I would say it in exactly that way. I think they still want to be involved, but they would be perhaps much more critical than the reformers. There is a role for radical and prophetic critics of existing social structures, but there is also a role for Josiahs who try to reform a corrupt temple or other institutions of society. The United States is a very democratic country, in the most powerful country in the world, for those of us who live here and can influence the most powerful government in the world, how can we not do that? But to do that, you have got to be a player and be ready to compromise sometimes. You have to become involved and know these things from the inside. Beckman is also a ordained Lutheran clergyman. A less optimistic view is by, and he's a liberal figure, he's actually a socialist, Jacques Attali, the well-known French socialist who has the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development. He essentially writes off billions of people in the South as, quote, millennial losers, unquote. Africa, to him, is a lost continent, while Latin America is sliding into, quote, terminal poverty, unquote. With no future of their own, the people of the South can only look forward to migrating from place to place, looking for a few drops of what we have in the United States and Europe, which for them will be oases of hope, emerald cities and countries of plenty and high-tech magic. Pretty pessimistic, some people are, about the possibilities to improve the situation in the world. This huge gap between rich and poor, this huge increase in population, which most people don't understand the exponential function very well. They think, I'm only getting 4% on my money now. And that's hardly anything. Of course, if you're talking about population growth, 4% growth is actually a cancer-like growth rate of population, because that means a doubling every, if you divide, the trick is to divide 4, in, you divide the growth rate into 70. So 4 into 70 is about 17, or 4 into 72 actually, better comes out even, doesn't it? 18, doubling every 18 years. You double something every 18 years. If it's your money, you probably think that's nothing. That's not good enough. But if it's a lot of other things, that's a tremendous growth rate. Well, even if we cut the growth rate all the way back to 1.4%, for the world's population. That means 100 years from now, there'll be 25 billion people on the planet. That means essentially a doubling every 50 years. I imagine the planet can sustain 25 billion people if, you know, 24 billion of them are living like the poor and the marginally poor of the world are living now. It probably can't sustain 25 billion people living like we are in this country presently. I don't know whether it can or not, but I'd like to pass out the last, this is actually a couple of chapters from this book, Dark Victory, by Waldo Bello. It's kind of an organization like Bread for the World. Food First is. And there's also at the introduction of the first chapter a quote by this fellow, Jacques Attali, that I just read from, the pessimistic one. It's essentially about what happened to the third world in the 1980s. There had been an increase in wealth amongst most third world people up until about 1980. They were getting some oil income in some of those countries, and that upset some people in this country. And Ronald Reagan was a personification of that. He not only wanted to roll back the Soviet Union, he wanted to roll back the Third World. Uh, the Soviet Union was rolled back, whether or not we needed to double U.S. defense spending and go from the leading creditor nation in the world to the leading debtor nation in the world is another question. Perhaps it was just coincidentally that the Soviet Union fell. As early as 1983 or 84, Gorbachev, and I think he became the leader of the Soviet Union in 85, but he had said that the Soviet Union should not match what the United States was doing with regards to military spending. In 1982, when Soviet technology went head-to-head with U.S. technology in Lebanon, it was no contest. It was 80-0. American planes downing Soviet planes. Of course, Israelis were flying their American planes. Maybe they were much better pilots than the Syrians flying the Soviet planes, but I think it had something to do with the fact that our planes were just better. And of course, Reagan kind of ran on the platform that we'd had a decade of neglect of our military. But when members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff were asked when they come to Congress every year whether or not they would trade their military counterpart, service counterpart, for the Soviet counterpart, they always said no in the late 70s and early 80s. They said, we have the best trained, the best equipped. And that was kind of proven out, I think, in situations where there was a match. And so we spent a lot of money on weapon system. We spent a lot of money on $600, toilet seats and expensive hammers. Some of it was wasted. Some of it maybe was well spent. And we were able to, build up Iraq over 10 years and then level it in a few days. And we built it up to the GNP equivalent of Arizona, and then we leveled it, but to keep the oil flowing. So we spend about $40 billion a year on protecting oil supply lines. We kind of think we have a right to, almost have a right to oil from the Middle East, even though it's really not part of the United States. We have that kind of feeling that at a fair price too, they can't charge too much for it. So economically, the difference between the Soviet, the CIA overestimated the economic strength of the Soviet Union by a factor of 2.5 times. They said that the Soviet economy was equivalent to about 60% of the American economy. Well, in about 1989, 1991, they started to revise that. Because, of course, more and more U.S. citizens were going there and seeing the absolute third world condition of much of the Soviet people. And they revised that down to about 25%. And they were probably always on the high side. But that's an organization, that we spend $30 billion a year on. The CIA, and unfortunately they kind of missed the mark a few times, and have over the years. Reagan also wanted to roll back the Third World, and he did that through the World Bank and the IMF. When the World Bank was headed by McNamara in the 70s, it was fairly liberal, and perhaps too liberal. It gave these loans for big projects that probably were inappropriate. There's a good book called Small is Beautiful by E.F. Schumacher, a real genius, I think. Many of these places would have been better off with solar box cookers. I happen to live in a community and actually work for a guy, a utility commissioner in Arizona. He has a chicken farm, and on that farm he allows people to store things there and to run businesses out of his chicken farm, out of these converted chicken coops. And two women back in the 70s came up with this idea of a simple box cooker. made out of cardboard and aluminum foil. Now there's an international organization out of Sacramento, or out of Davis, next to Sacramento. Solar Box Cookers International. The solar box cooker is a dramatic, it's simple, but it's a dramatic change for much of the third world, where many of the people spend much of the day hunting for increasingly hard to find wood or cow chips or whatever to build their fires with. And generally those people are women to do this. You have to kind of change their mindset about the need for fire and that kind of thing. But solar box cookers can actually improve the land too, because instead of collecting all that wood, it eventually decays and improves the soil if you leave it there. You're not stripping everything from the landscape. Well, solar box cooker allows you to cook your meal gradually, slowly. You set it out there maybe at 9 a.m. You kind of pre-cook things in the morning, you cook things during the day, and if you have two or three of them, you can actually have a meal ready for noon too. And it kind of keeps things warm for the afternoon, for the evening meal. It's a marvelous little device. It's not a big power plant that costs billions of dollars or hundreds of millions of dollars. It's not a hydroelectric plant. Another marvelous little thing is a water pump that can pump water from a depth of 200 feet using a photovoltaic array of about 200 watts, 1/5 of a kilowatt. And maybe if you added another little bit of an array, photovoltaics are coming down in price now, and they're still fairly expensive. But as we use them more and more, they'll be down to $1,000 to $2,000 per kW. Which for then you divide that by 5, and you get 200 watts. Maybe that you could probably have an electric light bulb too. Of course, you'd have to have a storage battery then if you wanted to use the light at night, because the photovoltaics only work in the daytime.
Did you say it pumps from 200 feet?
Yeah, 200 feet. But this is a marvelous...
How much?
Decentralized. Usually enough for a family.
And what's it called? What kind of water tank?
I can't remember if it has a... It's just a water pump.
Water pump.
Pumps water. Another marvelous technology for most people in the third world is a bicycle, rather than an automobile. They can actually afford bicycles. They can't afford automobiles, especially not when they cost $15,000. I can't even afford an automobile. I've only had one new one in my adult life. I'm almost 50. So there are certain people in these societies that think that they have to have everything that we have in the United States, and it's generally the elites in those societies. Most of the people in those societies who see their children starving would be perfectly willing to live with some of these low-tech, simple technologies that work very well. Of course, bankers don't get rich with this kind of stuff. There's not a lot of money floating around. They're all relatively inexpensive. I'll let you read if you like, on your own, some of this stuff. There's a debate going on between Waldo Bello and David Beckman over just whether or not the World Bank is doing any good at all or not.
Bello points out that in the Philippines in 1972, the poverty rate was 40%. Marcos was the dictator in the Philippines at the time, and he was up through the mid-80s until they had that peaceful, nonviolent revolution. Well, the World Bank poured $6 billion into the Philippines, and by 1986, the poverty rate was, what, anybody get it? 70%.
70%, yeah.
And that's the kind of development, essentially, in the world. The World Bank was encouraging these big projects, you know. And World Bank's not interested in solar box cookers, or hasn't been. I hope they get interested in that kind of technology. Solar box cookers, bicycles, and small photovoltaic water pumps. The last area I'd like to deal with is the area here in the United States. We have an increasing gap between rich and poor in the United States, too. The top 1% in the United States increased their share of the after-tax income almost 50% in the 1980s. Top 20% increased about 1%. Everybody else lost ground. That's part of the overall pie. The middle 60% dropped about 3.5%. The bottom 20% dropped about a percentage point. As I said in my reflection on was it Thursday? Hunger Awareness Lunch Day. Great Britain is about 8% for their bottom 20%, and Brazil about 1.5%. So we're heading toward Brazil. Some of this is due to the fact that it's how we tax people in this country. We're increasingly depending on a regressive tax, the payroll tax, the FICA, the Social Security tax. Individual income tax is part of the federal tax sources. In the 1970s, it was 52%, 1980s, 46%, 90 to 93, 45%. Payroll taxes have increased from 25%, they increased the whole 10 percentage points in the 1980s, and they're now at about 37%. Corporate taxes are going down, and the rest of the taxes are excise, gasoline taxes, and so on. But so these numbers don't add up to 100%. But an indication of that is Ross Perot made $230 million in 1991, I believe. He came up with a tax program, and most of that income is on municipal bonds, which are tax-free, so he doesn't. He only paid 6.8% of his income in taxes, which is less than a $10,000 laborer pays in FICA taxes. That's now about 7.1%. So Ross Perot, on $230 million, paid about $16.8 million in federal income tax. Under his tax plan that he put forth in the 1992 presidential campaign, he would have paid 6.7%. So I suppose those rich guys they deserve to keep all the money they made. But he made money in a society that provided, you know, the infrastructure. He couldn't have made that kind of money in most society. The United States has had fairly good tradition of, you know, people have gone into debt so that we could have what we have now. They built schools, and universities, and roads, and dams. Some of it's not been so good, but some of it's not been so bad either. Child poverty. The United States is more than double the next country, which is Canada. And these other countries have some things for their kids that we don't have. They have universal health care. You take a sick child to some hospitals, and they'll ask, they're supposed to accept, if they receive federal money to build a hospital, they're supposed to accept damn near everyone, but if they're busy, they might ask, well, do you have insurance? Do you have $1,000? If you don't have, they'll say, well, we have a county hospital that will take you, and it's not that far away. If the child isn't too sick, the child might make it there and be treated. If the child, sometimes you don't know how sick the child is, and it might die anyway, and children have. Federal spending as a percentage of GNP. We heard that Reagan was really against government, and he was going to cut government spending. Big lie. Real big lie. In the 1970s, 21.1% of our GNP was spent by the federal government. In the 1980s, it increased by almost 2.5 points. That's a dramatic change. Of course, he spent a lot on the military. He didn't do anything about the increase in entitlements. He cut some programs for the poor and so on. They went up, but they didn't go up as fast as they had in the past. So that's what a cut means usually in Washington, that you don't allow it to increase as fast as it had previously. In 1991, Bush, the president proposes a budget. The Congress then considers it. They make changes, and the Congress then passes it, and the president then signs it, usually. There's no line item veto, so. But Bush essentially proposed a budget at 25% of GNP in 1991, and Congress, monkeyed with a little bit. But, well, Clinton's, being lambasted by Rush Limbaugh, and I have my problems with Clinton in a number of areas that you probably heard if you've been in some of my other classes. But he's not exactly a big spender. He's heading back towards the 1970s with regards to spending as a percentage of GNP. That's not really a fair charge to say that he's a big spender. He didn't get his $16 billion jobs bill through. And we've never had a real recovery, and we haven't had a jobs recovery in this country yet. We've never had a real recovery or an expansion of our economy without a lot of stimulus from the government. And the military spending provided that, basically in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. The railroads did back at the end of the 19th century. So we probably need some of that if we're going to have a real recovery with some fairly good jobs. Otherwise, we're going to keep going this way, down towards Brazil. Federal debt as a percentage of GNP. This doesn't really have a whole lot to do, but it does with justice, economic justice, because you've got people like Paul Tsongas and Warren Rudman with a group called the Concord Coalition saying that we should balance the budget tomorrow. Well, actually, if the economy is growing faster than the debt, as it did from 1945 to 1980. In 1945, at the end of World War II, the total debt of the United States was 120% of our gross national product. We'd gone into debt to fight the war. And good thing, too, I think. Even though the debt increased from $100 billion to $950 billion, essentially a 900% increase, as a percentage of GNP, because the economy was growing faster than the debt, in 1980, the debt was about 33% of the gross national product. Well, Reagan said we can do three things when he was elected. We can cut your taxes. We can double defense spending, and we can balance the budget. Well, he certainly wasn't right about balancing the budget because it started to go up. And by the time he was out of office, it was about 65% of GMT. And it's now somewhere between 65, I think, and 70% of GMP. It increased some during Bush, too. Actually, Clinton, the deficit, and there's a difference between debt and deficit. Deficit is the yearly, I think most of you probably understand that. The deficit is only like about 2% of the economy, I think, in the 1995 budget, whereas in the Reagan-Bush years, it had generally been 5 to 6%. So he's maybe starting to level it off, but unless we can control healthcare spending, which is also a vital issue for economic justice, and healthcare spending has been going up about like this. In 1960, we spent 5% of GNP on healthcare in the United States. When Canada went to its universal system in 1971, both of us were spending 7.5% of GNP. Now Canada is just under 10%, and we're at 14 or 15%. If we keep going on that track, why 7.5, 10, now 14 or 15, in another 35 years, we'll be at about 35% of GNP on healthcare. So Clinton, I don't think his program is the right one, but I think he's talking about at least an issue that is very important. And it's very important not only for the healthcare of the American people, but also for the economy of the United States. An economy that spends that much on healthcare is hurting, by the way. You don't have money to spend on other things then. So the question is whether or not we can solve some of our problems with regards to the major thing is the entitlements and healthcare to see whether or not this goes up, levels off, or starts to go down again.